And good evening and welcome to Bird Calls from Red River Radio, made possible by the Knoll Foundation and the Community Foundation of North Louisiana. We invite you to call in with your questions tonight about our feathered friends and the avian world during the show at 800-552-8502. That's 800-552-8502. Cliff Shackelford is our resident ornithologist here at Red River Radio, and he is ready to answer your questions about birds tonight. Cliff is currently the statewide non-game ornithologist for the Texas Parks and Wildlife Department, a position he has held since 1997, and he has been an avid bird watcher for more than 30 years. He is also the first author of the book Hummingbirds of Texas, published in 2005 by Texas A&M University Press. And he has authored over 70 publications on birds and birding. He and his wife, Julie, and their two children live in East Texas. Cliff, thanks for joining me again.
Well, I'm glad to be indoors in the cool AC because pretty brutal out there.
It is indeed, and the heat is just a building all summer long. We've got a big dome of heat boiling everything from literally Minnesota, where they had highs and heat index is higher than ours yesterday. Oof. So you have to wonder, maybe those birds are going to actually come south for the Oof. Summer. That would be a strange phenomenon.
Yeah, those poor winter Texans went the wrong way.
Yeah, bad place to go. Alaska, I think, is the place to go now if you're going to, you know, summer it out of the south. So, well, let me give the numbers again. Go ahead and give us a call tonight if you have a question about our avian world at 800-552-8502. Again, that's 800-552-8502. Any questions about birds, birding, or our natural scape and the birds and how they fit into that natural scape are welcome tonight. And at the end of last month and at the end of every month now, we give a conservation tip. And Cliff, can you please refresh our memories about what we talked about last month?
Yeah, we talked about something that's really applicable in this heat, and that's a bird bath. I think a lot of people want to attract birds closer to their window, to their home, so they can enjoy them and see them. And feed isn't really what they're after when it's this hot. And Mother Nature typically gives lots of seeds and insects this time of the year. But what those birds really need when the creeks start drying up and the little puddles start drying up is a bird bath, not only for drinking, but also for feather maintenance, for keeping clean. So birds are very meticulous, and they have to be, in order to take flight. So their feathers have to be in really good shape. They have to be clean, free of ectoparasites. And so a bird bath really is important. It's essential for a lot of species. And we maintain one, and I'm talking about just a simple cement pedestal type bird bath where you just have to refill it, especially after the brown thrasher or blue jay gets in it. Because those guys really go bonkers with the bathing and flick the water everywhere. And it's really fun to watch. And what I think is the best is when a bird is done bathing, they just look like they went through the wash. And so they just look different. Their feathers are wet. They look kind of miserable. Or they're probably not miserable. They just look terrible. And then they start the fluffing up and the drying and shaking off the water, much like a dog does. And then they look great again after it dries. But those first few moments when they're just soaking wet, they just look funny. And it's tough to identify some of them. I mean, I've seen some birds when they're totally wet, you're like, what is that? And you have to wait a few minutes till they start drying off, and you see the colors and the characters that tell you what bird that is.
They come out and they look like they had a bad night the night before.
That's right. It's a bad hair day for sure, but they're probably feeling a lot better. So we recommend maintaining a bird bath, and that means this time of the year replacing the water with fresh water. Usually it goes bone dry. This time of the year it evaporates, so that makes it really easy. When there's not a lot of evaporation and several days have gone by, you just want to go out and with the hose and spray out the stagnant water and put in some fresh water. You don't need to add chemicals or soaps. These things are harmful. If you've got a bird bath that is getting a little thick with algae, then just stop running it for half a day, dry it out, stick it in the sun, put it on a part of your driveway or yard where you know it's going to get maybe 6 or 8 hours of just blinding sun, and that'll cook any of that algae away. And that way you can avoid chemicals and soaps and just do it a little bit more naturally, and it's definitely going to be a lot safer.
Now, are there some of those algaes actually harmful to the intestinal tract of birds, or do they have natural immunities which pretty much are going to protect them?
We don't. I don't know of any data to suggest that any of those are harmful. What's actually more harmful is when a bird that has an infection uses that feeder and then infects other birds. That's a big problem. It's kind of like in human terms, you know, you get someone with meningitis and they go to a university or a military base, boy, it just spreads like wildfire. Well, in the bird world, you can have something like trichomoniasis, and that can be spread at a bird bath. So that's another reason to keep it clean. And, you know, it's really tough to monitor. You don't want to say, okay, the bird just flew, let me go clean it. You don't need to do that. That's extreme. But I think just make sure that the water is clean every few days, every 2 or 3 days is best.
And, of course, they just had a breakout of the norovirus at the RNC convention, so you know how quickly that can, rapidly. If it's a disease that does affect a particular animal population, of course, they have immune systems quite different than ours. That's why frogs can live in swamp water, which we can't drink, but that doesn't mean that their immune system is perfect.
That's
and
right.
We protect them from every possible infection. So
yeah, so there is a cost at trying to congregate birds at a bird bath or a bird feeder. It's your responsibility, if you're going to do that, to make sure you're doing the best you can to keep it clean, to avoid these infections. So at a bird feeder, and we get this call a lot, oh, we've got these sick doves, they're under the feeder and they can't fly, they look terrible. That's probably an indication you need to quit feeding. Mm. There's something called aflatoxin that can get into our feed, our seed that we give birds, like cracked corn and sunflower seeds. When they get sweaty in this time of the year, they can get this fungus on them, and it's really a problem. So if you do see birds that look sickly, stop doing it, because you could be the problem, unknowingly,
right,
the problem. And if you keep feeding this seed that's a problem, and you can't look at the seed, nor does the bird look at the seed and see that it's laden with aflatoxin. You can't detect that except in a lab, and that takes days and hundreds of dollars. So
Right. Best
thing to do is just stop the feeding, throw the feed out or bury it deep, and start with a new batch. You might have a tainted bag of seed. And that would be the best thing for the birds.
So would that be something that if you had bird seed, you might want to store it inside rather than outside?
Absolutely.
As a way of protecting it from that, basically a fermentation type process
that
can go on even with dried grains and dried seeds because of the heat and the humidity and everything.
Yeah, if you're storing your lawnmower out in the shed that's not climate controlled, that's fine. But I wouldn't store something like the seed out there. You could maybe use something to keep the moisture down in that room. But yeah, if you can, put it in the laundry room during this sweaty time of the year.
And if you do find bugs around it, give us a call during What's Bugging You next month. We'll tell you how to deal with those too.
That's right.
So we start off each month with a spotlight bird. And this month you have selected what for us?
We have selected the Northern Bob White. And I have quite a lot to say about the Bob White. I got to working on some bullets here, and I just found all kinds of neat stuff about this bird. And let's listen to this. Wait for it. There we go.
He's not an overly verbal
There we go. And that's the Bob White whistle that we just heard is the one that's most often heard starting in late spring and through the summer. Let's hear it again. Bob White. And so that's a great example of the bird's name's a great example of what we call onomatopoeia or an echoic, whereby the bird emits a sound that we humans form into words. So he gets that name because of the sound it makes. Killdeer is another one, Chuck Will's widow, whippoorwill. There are a whole bunch of these onomatopoeias or echoics. Now we have a second call that you're going to key up here, and this one is more year-round. Let's listen to the second call, the Bob White. So this one is called the Hoy or the Hoyi call versus the Bob White call that we heard earlier. And so still the same critter, just doing different things at different times of the year. So Bob Whites form coveys, I think most people know, And it can be 30 to 20 individuals. It's usually a mix of both sexes. Range-wide, the bobwhite has experienced a severe decline of over 65%, according to nearly half a century of breeding bird survey data. So the decline here in the Red River radio listening area, I think, is much worse. So hearing or seeing a bobwhite is a rare treat these days in this area. There are a couple last big holdouts for the species. They appear to be way west of us in the rangeland of the Rolling Plains, west of Wichita Falls, Texas, and also in South Texas brushlands, south and west of Corpus Christi, Texas. But in those areas, it's not surprising that land ownership is large, and that means landowners own more acreage, which leads to less fragmentation and more rangeland, which is what the bobwhite needs. So we have to think of large chunks of real estate if we want to bring back the northern bobwhite. The species can't thrive long-term in areas of less than about 5,000 acres of usable space. Some authorities are now throwing out a figure of 200,000 acres as being necessary for long-term survival of bobwhite. So if you want to bring back quail on, say, your 100-acre property, obviously you'll need to work with lots of your neighboring landowners to make it happen. So the bobwhite's a popular game bird. It brings in big revenue. According to one source, the bobwhite hunters average spending about $8,600 over nearly 9 days of quail hunting during the 2010-2011 hunting season in West Texas. And a lot of that money goes into the local economy because they're buying gas, they're staying in hotels, they're eating in the restaurants, etc. They're usually foreigners, people not necessarily out of the country, but they're travelers coming into that area to hunt quail. But overall, the changes we've made to our native grasslands and savannas are the root of this bird's decline. Native grasses and forbs maintained by frequent fire are key. Over the last century, we've severely altered the landscape by suppressing fires and replacing native grasses and forbs with non-natives, usually monocultures of things like coastal Bermuda, fescue, KR bluestem, and other exotics. They're from the Mediterranean, they're from Africa and elsewhere in the old world. So the marketing phrase we hear, quote, made in the USA, quote, end quote, it sure applies here. And that's what the quail needs, is grass that's made in the US. The release of caged quail is not the solution, since such birds, once released, have a lifespan estimated to be a couple weeks. They're just not bred with wild savvy. Instead, they're inexperienced pen-raised birds that have no idea how to survive. Periodic fire, historically ignited by lightning, it maintains the healthy grass understory for bobwhite and other grassland-inhabiting species. There are other species of birds that use this same habitat, like eastern meadowlark and loggerhead shrike, just to name a few, and they're experiencing similar declines, which signal to us that the habitat alterations we've made are a serious issue. If you want to hear or see a bobwhite in the Red River listening area, the best chance you have is on our national forest managed by the U.S. Forest Service, where prescribed fire is still used to keep pine stands open with that lush growth of native grasses and forbs. And we have, Bill, on the Bird Calls web page of the Red River Radio website, we've got a great photo of a male northern bobwhite that was snapped by James Childress. So I encourage people to go look at that picture, and also the calls you just played are archived there, yep. And people can go. But I think most people know what the bobwhite call, but maybe the hoy or hoye call, yeah, we played. Maybe most people didn't know what that was, and you may hear that if you're lucky, but it's super hard to find a bobwhite these days in the piney woods. It's unfortunate.
You are listening to Bird Calls with our resident ornithologist, Cliff Shackelford, and you can give us a call tonight at 800-552-8502. That's 800-552-8502. I'm going to try to get to our first call now. Gina from Nacogdoches, you're on. Okay, well, we did lose Gina. Uh-oh. From Nacogdoches. So, Gina, if you'd like to call back in, please do. We have all lines open right now. 800-552-8502 is the number for you to call right now. So other things that we can do right now to mitigate the heat factor. Of course, you know, birds are, you know, designed to handle this heat, but even this is getting extreme, probably, at least within the last 20 to 30 years in our area.
Well, Yeah, I mean, it's may, you know, they say it's just a percent, small percentage of a increase in temperature, but I mean, these birds are used to it. This is the temperate zone where it's going to get hot, so it's not unusual to see triple digits. It's those summers where we get, you know, 20 days of it in a row or something crazy like that, that we probably, and there's nothing we're going to do about on the immediate sense, but I think a lot of these birds are used to it.
And Gina did call back. Thank you, Gina. Gina, you're online with Cliff Shackelford. What's your question tonight?
Yeah, hi, Cliff. I'm trying to make my yard more bird-friendly, and I'm going back to your question, your information on bird baths. I want to put a bird bath up, but I'm concerned this time of year about how hot it is. Does the water heating up in the bird bath affect how the birds use it? Does it need to be in the shade? Is it okay to be in the sun or what?
Yeah, that's a great question. I don't think you're ever going to see the water boil, so that's not a problem.
No, but right.
Yeah, but I think a little bit of shade is good. And a little bit of sun where it maybe gets a mix of the two. Too much shade, you might get the algae. And also, you don't want the shade too close to the water bath, because that could be where the neighbor's cat is hiding to pounce on the bird.
Yeah.
So you want to make sure the shade is probably from the canopy way up high. But I don't think you'd have to worry about that. And a bird does make a decision if for some reason there's something wrong with it. They won't use it, but I don't think too hot is ever a problem.
Okay, yeah. Well, that's very useful. No, that makes me feel better.
Yeah, great. Thanks, Gina. Yeah.
Thank you, Gina, for calling in. And you are listening to Bird Calls with our resident ornithologist, Cliff Shackelford. You can give us a call right now at 800-552-8502. That's 800-552-8502. Any question concerning our avian world, birding, and how to make your yard a little more friendly for our natural environment is a good subject matter tonight. We're going to go next to Robert from Nacogdoches as well. Robert, you're online with Cliff Shackelford. What's your question tonight?
I had a cattle raising friend over in the Crockett area who had the theory that cattle egrets were reducing the quail population, that the baby quails running around on the ground look like food to the cattle egrets. Would you give that any credibility?
Well, I think, you know, I hear the same exact thing from people blaming fire ants. And I think we always want to have a scapegoat, and it's really nice when it's a single scapegoat. But I think that the cattle egret, you know, they didn't get here and get into big numbers until the last four decades. So they were not, they actually started coming in when quail started declining, but I don't think you can't suggest that that's related. What I'm really an advocate for is the non-native grass. And so what we've done is we've chosen to use old world grasses that are usually cool season grasses to raise our cattle. And so beef production has won over quail. And that's the number one concern that I have. And so when you change those grasses, then you get, you're promoting fire ants. When you're disturbing the soil, when you're haying, you're encouraging cattle egrets to be there. But no, I think I hear that a lot, and then I hear people change that story, and that's why wild turkeys aren't here, because the cattle egrets are eating the poults. And I think it's just, I don't think it's the full picture. I think it could be a little pinprick when what we're talking about is a complete arm or leg being chopped off by the non-native grasses. So I think that the cattle egret and the fire ants are later on. They're more of a little pinprick and not the severe blood-curdling arm loss that this bird has been experiencing.
Thank you.
Yeah.
You are listening to Bird Calls with our resident ornithologist, Cliff Shackelford. And you can give us a call right now at 800-552-8502. That's 800-552-8502. Any question concerning our avian world and our birds and how to make a better ecosystem for them is welcome. And we have Merkel from Marksville up next. Give us a call if you can. Merkel, you're online with Cliff Shackelford. What's your question?
Yes, good afternoon.
Hello.
Hello.
Howdy. Go ahead.
This is in reference to the scissortail flycatcher.
Okay.
Recently, I've been sighting these birds, and I thought the furthest east was Orange, Texas. But I've been seeing these, and there are two varieties, it seems. One is a larger bird with a beautiful scissor tail, and another one is a little smaller. And I just wanted to know what information you could give me.
Okay, well, let's try to clear the identification here. If you're seeing one that's larger with a scissor tail and one that's smaller, and we're talking noticeably larger and smaller, we might be talking about two different critters. The larger one being the swallowtail kite, and that one would be, you know, it's a raptor. It's very graceful. It's black and white. It soars. It doesn't hardly flap. It makes flight look very easy. The scissor-tail flycatcher is much smaller. We're talking about the size of a mockingbird or cardinal, but with a long tail. And he's going to be on the light posts, on the fence posts, and a lot of flapping and a lot of catching, quick jaunts out, what we call sallying out for insects. That's the scissor-tail. So the range of those, so the swallowtail kite occurs in the entire southeast, so from Texas to Florida. So that's not a recent thing. Historically, they occurred even farther to the north up the Atlantic coast, and it's been greatly reduced. But the scissor-tail flycatcher is a bird that did have a much more limited range than today. But what we've done in the last century or so is opened up the piney woods and farther east, where scissor-tails and roadrunners and other birds that are typically considered more westerly have expanded east. So I think if you know, today they're not unusual, but if we were standing here 200 years ago, scissor-tail might be unusual in central Louisiana. But we've just opened it up and made it open for them, where they can inch eastward as they so are doing. That's a good observation. But they're here and they're here to stay. But the mother lode of scissor tails for breeding is really central Texas, up into Oklahoma, and so it happens to be, of course, the state bird of Oklahoma. You see it on their license plate. And that's too bad, because I sure wish Texas would have jumped on that first. What a great looking bird! So I'm glad you're looking out for your scissor tails.
Thank you, son. I appreciate it.
Thank you, Merkel.
You are listening to Bird Calls with our resident ornithologist Cliff Shackelford, and you can give us a call tonight at 800-552-8502. That's 800-552-8502. We have lines open. Brian, you're on hold for a moment. We're going to go next to Jimmy from Bossier City. Jimmy, you're online with Cliff Shackelford. What's your question?
Okay. Yes, we have some cardinals, and they keep running into the windows and pecking the windows. Mm-hmm. Now, we've had that problem before when we lived in South Louisiana, and we had them before where they think they was flying right through the house because we got windows on each side of the house. But this year, they just pecking on the windows. They run, they fly, and they'll hit the window.
Mm-hmm.
They'll get on a limb next, we have a tree next to our window in the bedroom, and he'll sit there and he'll run into it again and just peck it.
And that's a very common call, and that's the number one species we get is the cardinal, because they're so familiar to us in the backyard, and they really do well in backyards. But what they do see is their reflection. And so if you go outside where that cardinal is, he sees something bright red, and he says, oh my gosh, this is my home, and here's an intruder, and I'm going to attack it. So he's attacking his own reflection. So keep in mind, this bird's got a pea-sized brain, and he can't figure it out. So he keeps doing it and keeps doing it. And so the best thing to do is maybe get some newspaper or butcher paper and tape it up where it's a big problem if it bothers you. It's not going to kill the bird. It probably needs to figure out something else to do with its time. But a lot of people complain about them doing that to their rear view mirror on their vehicle parked in the driveway too. They'll sit on your side mirror of your truck or your car and lean over and see themselves and start pecking at it. It's usually not a problem until they sit there so long that they're also pooping, and people don't like the big pile of poop on the window. So
we haven't had that problem yet.
Thank no, goodness. But I think that's going to solve your problem. And for your cardinal is to just obstruct the view. You can put the butcher paper on the inside or the outside. Some people put up potted plants where the problem is really happening, and that would just break up the reflection and maybe get the bird to move on.
Well, what I think we're going to do is I've done this to block the sun, is get some dark screen and Velcro it to the frame,
yeah,
on the inside, and that'll stop him from going. That's what I figured. I think he was seeing himself, you know.
Yeah.
When I go around and clean the windows, I see myself in it, and I said, well, that's what they're doing, but I just wanted to confirm it.
No, that's good, and I'm glad you called, because a lot of people buy, they go online and they figure out what do we need to buy. We always have to buy something to fix a problem. Well, this is not one we have to really buy anything. We all have newspaper or something handy. But some people buy raptor silhouettes that are just these black blobs that are a hawk or falcon flying, and you put it on the window. That's intended for these big windows where birds are migrating and flying through a breezeway. That actually helps them see that there is glass. But your cardinal is sitting at the edge of the glass. He's not trying to fly through it. He, again, is pecking at his own reflection.
Yeah, he's an intruder in his territory.
Yeah, and that'll go away. That's not a year-round thing. It's usually when the testosterone is the highest, but the females do it too. She doesn't want a girlfriend in her territory either. So there are female cardinals that do this too.
Yeah.
So it's not just the boys doing it; it's the girls
Even some of the young ones are doing it too.
Yeah. Yeah. So this is an alpha thing, and it's because these birds are territorial, and they just don't do well this time of the year with having intruders in their home.
Right.
Yeah.
Well, I'm going to fix it up with that dark screen and Velcro inside.
Thanks, Jimmy.
You are listening to Bird Calls with our resident ornithologist, Cliff Shackelford, and you can give us a call right now at 800-552-8502. That's 800-552-8502. Any question concerning birds, our avian world, and how to make a more friendly eco-environment for them. We're going to go next to Brian from Texarkana. Brian, you're online with Cliff Shackelford. What's your question?
Hey, Cliff.
Hey, Brian.
I got a question for you. I'm pretty certain that I've identified at least one and possibly even a breeding pair of red-cocked native woodpeckers.
Okay.
I live in a fairly remote area. We've got a lot of, undisturbed, woods and all that. However, there is starting to be some encroachment as far as building, development, and things like that.
Yeah.
Is there anything other than just somehow miraculously convincing people to not build, anything that can be done to keep these, critters in the area?
Well, first of all, I'd have to see a photograph to ensure that it is a red cockaded. I would think you're most likely having a downy woodpecker if you have
right.
a small woodpecker. So red cockaded hasn't been in Texarkana or anywhere near there in probably 30 years.
Oh, wow.
I think maybe in the 80s there were some holdout RCW, what we call red-cockaded woodpecker, we call RCW. There were some clusters up there in the 80s, but not since then. And so you'd have to really document it to show that they're back. Their habitat is very specialized. It's mature pines, and they have a real unique way of excavating in a living pine, and they put these resin wells on the outside, and those resin wells ooze sap, and you can see it's kind of like candle wax running down the boles of these trees. And so downy woodpecker is a common backyard bird. They do well in urban settings, and I'm guessing that's what you have in Texarkana. But if you're looking for I don't know if this is a question about how you can stop development in your area, and it's not going to be by looking for the red cockaded. I'm afraid not. That's not going to work. So I think the only way to do it is buy it up. If you don't buy it up and protect it, someone else will.
Well, I certainly would if I could.
Yeah. Hey, play that lotto or that Powerball. So
that's not a bad idea. Yeah. I have to give that a shot.
Yeah, so. There you go.
All right, thanks, Brian. And you are listening to Bird Calls with our resident ornithologist, Cliff Shackelford. You can give us a call right now at 800-552-8502. That's 800-552-8502. Any question concerning birds and our avian world is welcome. And Mike from Pineville, you are up next. Mike, what's your question tonight?
Thank you. This is the first time I've ever heard the show. I caught it on the way home. I enjoyed it. My question or is an observation, the Bob White caught my ear because I grew up listening to the Bob White every night. We mm-hmm. lived out in the country, and it's really something I wish my kids could hear. Mm-hmm. And so I've got a question, Cliff. It's probably not bird-related, but I'm hoping since the Bob White is gone, another thing that reminds me in my childhood along with the Bob White was, it's probably an insect question, but do you have any idea why the lightning bugs are gone?
Yeah, and Bill mentioned the other show, companion show, is What's Bugging You, and that would be a better call for the entomologist Beverly to deal with, and I'm not gonna touch that one since this is a bird show.
Well, I don't know when that show comes on. I'll just catch it when I'm driving, but I'm thinking they're probably not gonna be able to answer it, but I'll check it out and find out when it comes on. But I've enjoyed the calls, and I have to put my mom on this because she's the bird watcher.
Oh, great.
But anyway, you know, I'm still working a job. She's got time to do it, retired. But I appreciate you taking the call, and I'm going to continue listening when I can on Thursday. So
and
thank
Mike,
you very much.
Mike, What's Bugging You, like this show, is the third Tuesday generally of every month. So What's Bugging You will be on the third Tuesday of August. And then Cliff will be back in September. And we do these every other month.
Yeah.
It's the birds and the bees show, basically.
Yeah.
We just don't get them together.
I've been listening to the news in the morning, and I've been hearing this advertisement about it come on. So I'm on the way home, and I turn it on. I'm like, oh, that's the show. So,
All
right. Well, thank you very much.
By the way, for those listening, we have a whole host of podcasts of past shows on our website, so if you'd like to check those out, plus old bird photos that other people have sent in, audio and the whole like, that is a great way to go ahead and kind of expand your knowledge and information about the birding world is by going to our website.
Yeah, and speaking of the podcast, according to my notes, this is our 18th episode,
right?
So that's a lot of hours, and one of them is a double episode. So that's you're looking at 19 hours of bird calls that you can go back and listen to, and you know, if you're having trouble sleeping at night, turn this on and it'll put you to sleep, right? No,
not sure about that.
No, we want you to stay
with
awake.
Our energy. But the nice thing is that all of that is there as an archive, and I don't think we've ever really gone over the same ground. So it's always a good question and always different questions.
And we profile a different species every time. Luckily, we've got over 300 birds that are potentially to work with, so I won't ever have to do the Bob White again. No offense to the Bob White, but we have to give every bird a chance to be on stage.
You're listening to Bird Calls from Red River Radio with our resident ornithologist, Cliff Shackelford, and you can give us a call at 800-552-8502. You might want to wait for a few minutes as all lines are full up right now. We're going to go next to Rex from Dallas. Rex, you're online with Cliff. What's your question?
Cliff, this is Rex Morgan. You and I have met through our mutual friend Billy Hicks before.
Oh, hey, Rex. Great.
And you were very successful in calling up some owls for us on several New Year's Eve, if my memory serves me well.
Yeah, those are very fun owl prowls that we would do up in Franklin County.
That was really fun.
Yeah.
And thank you so much for recognizing my name.
Uh-huh.
I am driving on Interstate 30 right now. I do live in Dallas. I've just crossed into Texarkana, and I've always got NPR on. I wanted to ask my question about Chuck Will's widow. You mentioned that when you were talking about the Bob White recently.
Yeah.
In the mid-70s, when I first lived in Texas, I lived in Wood County between Hawkins and Mineola.
Mm-hmm.
And I heard the Chuck Will's widow every night, and I mean every night, Cliff, starting just after dusk, and would go till about the middle of the night. Never heard it in the morning.
Mm-hmm.
But I heard what you said about the Bob White, and I wanted to see hear your opinion. How's the Chuck Wills widow population doing in that part of our state?
Well, let's listen. Bill has fired up Chuck Wills' widow. Let's listen for a minute.
Okay.
Yeah.
And Rex, just so you know, this one was calling all night where I was living at in Florida about 10 years ago. And being a recording engineer and a geek, I just set my microphones out and recorded it all night long on a computer. I've got about 4 hours of this guy going.
Uh-huh.
And he actually moved up closer. I think he realized he was auditioning because at the end of the night, he was literally right by my microphone.
Well, let's turn it up for just a second. Listen.
Okay. I'd love to hear it again. Oh, yeah.
Yeah. And I'll tell you, when that bird is, if you're camping and he's right above your tent, it is painful trying to go to sleep. But when he's way off.
I was camping.
Yeah.
I worked for the salesmanship club program, and we were sleeping out almost every night.
When he's at a distance, though, and it's faint, it's very pleasant.
Yeah.
But yeah. I think that...
I loved it. It's part of my early memories of living in Texas.
Yeah, and that's a forest, generally a forest species. And it doesn't do well with all the lights that we have up. You might think, well, why doesn't it feed on the bugs coming to light? He's just not built for that. So I know some people say, well, I have a nightlight and I've got Chuck Wills widows. Well, you probably are in a rural setting where you've got a lot of big country, big rural land. So this is a bird that is not going to be in the city. Except on a rare occasion, it's going to be in your most rural settings. And actually, rural settings are getting to be far and fewer between. They're getting to be smaller and more fragmented.
Yes.
And I think that's not doing well for the Chuck Wills widow. And we don't know about any association it has with food prey. So it's maybe feeding on a specific moth or a genus of moth that is not doing well either. So we don't really know all the pieces of the puzzle, but I can tell you that you mentioned it was decades ago you had them, and that bird has definitely declined in the last 40 years. So, and it's just loss of green space that's favorable to Chuck Wills widow. Same thing with the Bob White we talked about. And what's interesting about the Bob White, people drive around, they go, well, look at all these green fields. What is he talking about? I see grasslands everywhere. It's not the right grass. It's, again, an old world species. It came from the Mediterranean or Africa, and people brought it here, and we've cultivated it, we've spread it, and it's just going gangbusters. And the Bob White don't like to sit on top of those monocultures of Bermuda grass. They like to be down on the ground, running between the clumps of the native blue stem. And so that's one of the reasons we don't have Bob White. Well, with the Chuck Wills widow, I think if we had more big woods, less light at night, we'd have a lot more of them. And it's also a migratory species, the Chuck Wills widow. They winter in the tropics, and they're facing the same problem on the wintering grounds. They go down to Central America, and boom, that area has changed. It's now turned into an ag field or a sun-grown coffee plantation or something else that's just not favorable. So it's doom and gloom, and I'm sorry you need a box of Kleenex when I talk about some of these things, but it's reality, and I have to take a chill pill all the time in this business because it's just depressing.
Yeah.
Yeah, it reminds me of the guy that called in about the loss of the lightning bugs.
Yeah. Yeah, and that's going to be a good one for Beverly on what's bugging you.
Absolutely.
Maybe profile the lightning bug and see what's going on there.
Yeah. Well, thank you for taking my call. Well, it's been a delight to talk to you.
Rex, good to hear from you.
My feeling is there's still some of them out there. I hear them on occasion at my lake house, but not like I used to.
No, that's right. That's right. Okay, Rex, you take care.
Yeah, and you really have to get out into the backwoods to hear those. I was living on literally 6 acres of virgin woodlands and grasslands, pine, and I just let it grow. I had basically a cabin up in the middle of there. And just let it grow and be what it is. And there was all kinds of natural birds and wildlife and deer and everything else. The only thing that was strange was the emu I found on my property once.
Yeah, he probably doesn't belong there.
No, he belonged on the farm down the road, but apparently I got him. So you are listening to Bird Calls, and that is a bird, by the way. You're listening to Bird Calls from Red River Radio with our resident ornithologist, Cliff Shackelford. We have lines open. Give us a call at 800-552-8502. We go next to George from Bossier City. George, you're online with Cliff. What's your question?
Yes, sir. Mr. Shackelford, I've been trying for years to identify a bird that I see fairly commonly. It's smaller than a hawk.
Okay.
It's got very pointed wings, a triangular tail.
Mm-hmm.
The wingtips are black. It orbits like a hawk, and it's some kind of raptor.
Mm-hmm.
I think you were talking about a swallow-tailed kite.
Yes, they have a deeply forked tail, though. Is that you said a triangular tail? So the swallowtail kite looks like he has a pair of scissors, envision scissors that are open, and that looks like.
It's distinctly triangular.
Okay.
The only thing I could find in the book that resembles it is a Mississippi kite.
Yep, and that's where I was going to go with your description. You were headed that direction, and it's a cousin of the swallowtail kite called the Mississippi kite, and they are very common in your area. They love the Red River Valley, all the way from Wichita Falls and all the way down to here and beyond, and elsewhere. But that bird is just a graceful soaring bird. You'll see them occasionally fold their wings and dive, and you're like, what is he doing? I don't see anything. Well, he caught an insect that his eyes could detect and ours can't, because most raptors, they can see about 8 times greater than we can. So he's after aerial insects like dragonflies, grasshoppers, moths, those kinds of things is what he's eating on the wing. So I bet you your bird is a Mississippi kite, and you actually identified it yourself. So whatever you did to peg it, I think you nailed it.
What you just told me really amazes me. What I saw today, I was standing on top of a tanker, and I was watching one. And it went into a dive. It folded its wings back and went into a dive, and then it pulled out. And I thought, well, the mouse or whatever he was going after must have went undercover, and he just aborted the attack or something. I didn't realize that he was like a scissortail flycatcher or whatever, that he's going for insects.
Yep. And when they catch it, you can, if it's something big enough that he has to tear it apart like a dragonfly, you'll sometimes see them use their feet and bring their feet towards their bill and tear off the wings and work on the fleshy part of the insect. But a lot of times it's small enough that they might just gulp it like we would a Cheeto and not worry about it. So, that's what you saw, is that the stooping behavior, stooping after a prey item, and it was an insect that was aloft, flying.
Well, I really appreciate
cool.
I've been trying to figure this out for years.
Well, that's great. I think that's the whole point of life, is to see things, question it, investigate it, and then have, like you are having right now, this moment of, hey, this is great, I figured it out. So now, George, you've got to find out what is the next question and quest in your life.
There you go.
Thank you for taking my call.
Okay. Thank you, George.
Thanks, George. And you are listening to Bird Calls with our resident ornithologist, Cliff Shackelford. You can give us a call now at 800-552-8502. We have lines open. That's 800-552-8502. Any question regarding our avian world and birds is welcome. We're going to go next to Raymond from Bronson, Texas. Raymond, you're online next. What's your question?
My question is about the painted bunny.
Okay.
I live about 40, 45 miles due east of Lufkin towards Spean River.
Mm-hmm.
And they occasionally, 20, 25 years ago, you'd see a painted bunny, and I haven't seen one in about 20 years. And I just wonder about their range, if it's shrinking, changing, shifting, whatever. I haven't really talked to anybody.
Yeah, I think with painted bunting, the habitat that they use is very ephemeral in most cases. And so they really do well in recent clear cuts. But once those clear cuts grow after maybe 2 years after cutting, it's great for painted bunnings. And then maybe for another 6 or 7 years, it's still good for painted bunnings. And then it gets too thick and too much of a pine monoculture, and the painted bunnings move on. So I think if you could find a painted bunning and look at that habitat and key into that, I think you'll have a better perspective, because when I drive around with the windows down on some of the roads out in your area, you're near Pineland and Broadus, and those are heavily cut over areas, and so it's a shifting mosaic. And so
it shifts so quickly.
It shifts so quickly, so you have to kind of gauge the stage that the pine plantation is in post-cutting. So I like to tell people when it looks like a Christmas tree farm and just Christmas trees, then it's not going to be any good. But when it's a lot younger and you've got a lot of grasses and herbaceous stuff and sumac and sweet gums and a variety of things, and it's usually below 6 feet tall, that's perfect for painted bunting. So think about that, and drop when you're driving around, maybe stop and listen. And this time of the year, there'll be painted buntings, they're still singing, but I wouldn't do it at 2 p.m. I'd do it at 6 a.m. They're going to be really more commonly singing when it's nice and cool and pleasant. They're no dummies. They're like us. They're siesta. They're siesta time at 2 o'clock. So a lot of those birds are just, they're still singing, but not as often as they are at 6, 7 in the morning. So there are lots of painted buntings in your area, and I think that maybe if you had a historical spot where you went, it's just grown out of that successional stage that they need. Does that make sense?
Yeah. Yeah, it very much does. Okay. That's probably why I haven't been seeing them, because I'm looking at the wrong time.
Yeah.
My wife has never seen one, and so I've been trying to, they exist.
Yeah, and that's one that once you master their song, you can hear it at 40 miles an hour as you're driving along, and you can stop. You can put the brakes on and go right to it. And other birds you'll hear in this area that are also associated with those regenerating pine plantations will be indigo buntings, yellow-breasted chats, hooded warblers.
I see both of those.
Yep. So those painted buntings are in there. They're just you just have to find that song and go after it and hopefully point it out to your wife, because once you see that bird, it is just, it's spectacular.
And with today's smartphones, you can record it for her and bring it back and bring the calls
that's
back.
That's right.
And
that's
send
them
in to us. We'd love to play them on the air.
Yeah.
May I ask one short other question?
Yeah, go ahead, Raymond.
Is there a, can you recommend a recording of bird songs for people who are learning? You can order.
Yeah, there are a lot of apps now for your cell phone that are really good, that you can, when you're sitting in the waiting room somewhere or riding in the elevator, you can just, pull up a bird and listen to the song right there on your cell phone. So I would recommend that. That's probably a really good way to do it. There's lots of websites. The allaboutbirds.org site that is run by Cornell Lab of Ornithology, that one's really good, and they have clickable sounds that you can find online too. So there's a whole bunch of sites. Okay. Yeah. Yeah.
Okay. Hey, thank you
good.
Very much.
Thank you, Raymond.
It's been just really delightful.
Thank you.
You bet. Thank you, Raymond. And Cornell is actually where a lot of the movies go to when they need bird sounds and sound effects as they go.
Yeah.
That famous, screeching sound of the hawk, that you see in the movies, that's always a specific Cornell lab.
Yeah, and
I know that one now because I know exactly what the pacing is between the three screeches.
And with Hollywood, there's so many bird watchers now that they'll call and write letters and harass you, your movie, if you dump in the wrong bird into the setting where the movie is taking place. And I'll never forget, it's been about 15 years ago, there was a live PGA golf tournament somewhere out east, and they were playing a western bird. I want to say it was a cactus wren. And they not only played the wrong bird. Well, first of all, why do they need to dub a bird sound in a darn PGA, when they're... they're talking soft. He's got the pitching wedge, and he's going to hit it. And now it's a 7-iron. Well, they dubbed the bird in, and they overdid it. So they got apparently just bombarded with emails and letters from bird watchers saying, "What are you doing? This is in the east, and you played a western bird. You've been had. We know you're duping us." So I think that's pretty funny, because I can't go to a movie or sit through a TV show without hearing that stuff, and when it's wrong, I'm like, it's just like if it's a 1950s movie and here comes a 1980s Mercedes, everybody's going to say, "Oh geez, what are they doing?" Well, they don't think that people are paying attention to the bird sounds, but let me tell you, there's 60 to 70 million bird watchers estimated in the U.S., and a lot of them are very savvy on the songs and calls, and they're going to catch it.
You are listening to Bird Calls with our resident ornithologist, Cliff Shackelford, and we're going to go to James next from Shreveport, and then we've got David up next, and then we'll get to our conservation tip. James from Shreveport, you're up next.
Hello?
Yes, okay. Well, I may not have James, or I may have the wrong name.
Actually, you have Jean, and I am from Shreveport.
Okay.
I live in a old neighborhood in Shreveport, mm-hmm. Near the Highland area, and at dusk, I hear a bird call, and please forgive me and don't laugh at me, but it sounds to me like it's saying, "Bertier, Bertier."
Hmm.
Does that ring a bell for anybody?
Jeez. Well, I'll tell you this, and Bill mentioned this earlier. If you have your cell phone, you can record that and call us in September and play it back. So your cell phone will have a video function. Don't worry about getting any visual. You're just using the microphone to grab the sound.
Uh-huh.
Yeah, and it just pointed out, you can actually email that file to us, and we can convert it and get the audio out of it and use it on the next show.
Yeah, but I mean, a whole bunch of species are racing through my head. I think that even the first part of a cardinal can sound like what you just described, and they'll keep singing close to dusk. So, but I don't know. I think it would be great if you called us back once you get that recording. So you, Jane, have a homework assignment.
Yes, I do. Thank you. And it's not even school yet.
Oh, well, you're in summer school then.
It's always school here at Bird Calls.
Yes, well, thank you very much. And
okay.
I will be doing that recording.
All right. Thank you.
Thank you. And we're going to go next to David from Nacogdoches, and we still have time for one more call. Give us a call at 800-552-8502 if you'd like to get the last call in tonight. David from Nacogdoches, you're online with Cliff. What's your question tonight?
Yeah, Cliff, this is Dave Wallace, and I just wanted to, my wife wants to know, what is the best bird or birds to attract in our local area to reduce the number of mosquitoes?
And Dave, do you always do what your wife tells you to do, like pick up the phone and call?
Absolutely.
Well, look at you. Look at you doing what the wife tells you to do. I like that.
He will live tomorrow.
Yep. And we've talked about this in past episodes, and the best mosquito killer is a dragonfly. He is going to not only eat when in the adult stage flying around, but in the nymph stage under the water, those immature dragonflies will eat the immature mosquitoes. So the answer is a dragonfly. Now, they have something similar to birds because they fly, but I think that most people want to say the answer is purple martin, but that's been debunked. That's not all accurate. I mean, they might eat a few, but the answer is dragonfly. So you're going to have a pond, some kind of aquatic system to get the dragonflies to breed, but I think if you look in most open fields, you'll see a lot of dragonflies, and they're the best mosquito killers out there.
Okay. All right. Well, thank you.
Okay. Thank you, Dave.
All right. And we've got time for one more quick call. Dottie from Gilbert, you're online with Cliff. What's your question?
Actually, I just wanted to add some information to the call about the cardinals pecking on the window.
Okay.
Our experience was we noticed one morning red, thought the bird had injured itself, and at closer inspection we discovered that he was feeding his image, looked like berries, seeds from berries.
Huh.
So we've been fascinated by that.
Well, that's interesting, because normally a male cardinal, part of the courtship is to feed its mate. But it's going to not look like himself. So that's a little interesting. I don't want to talk about what this male bird was doing with this male image of himself, but we won't go there.
Well, we thought he may have thought it was a little one, you know.
Maybe so.
They traveled around the house at different windows.
Or maybe he
really enjoyed the show.
Well, thank you. Maybe he was a peacemaker instead of fighting. Maybe he said, "Hey, man, I'll give you some food if you take off and leave my home." So maybe he was a lover, not a fighter.
That's what we need, don't we?
That's right.
holding,
thank you so much.
Holding out the olive branch, as it were. Yeah. So, all right, Cliff, I want to thank you. And we've got time enough to go to our next conservation moment here. So a conservation tip, could you give us this month's tip?
Yes, this tip is on fire, prescribed fire. It's going to tie into our Bob White that we talked about. So we all appreciate the importance of rainfall, sunshine, and soil for growing plants. But did you know that here in the temperate zone where grasslands, longleaf pine savannas, and marshes abound, that all of these also depend on periodic fire to maintain ecosystem health? So here in the southeastern U.S. where annual rainfall amounts are high, winter freezes are rare, plants grow very quickly. Historically, periodic natural fires, which were mostly created by lightning strike, would burn through these grasslands and forests every 3 to 5 years or so. And because they were so frequent, these were relatively cool fires since the fuel load hadn't had enough time to build up. The fire mostly kept to the underbrush and didn't kill the mature canopy trees like the oaks and the pines. Fire nourishes the soil, it helps some trees germinate like the longleaf pine in our listening area, and it kept the landscape open for abundant wildlife. Today, most of us fear fire and the damage it could do to our homes. As we've settled this continent, we've suppressed these periodic and necessary fires. Now, many of the animal species that live in fire-dependent plant communities are in trouble. Perhaps more importantly, without regular fire, fuel loads in forests have built up so that when accidental fires do start, the results can be catastrophic. So some land managers employ prescribed fire, which are low fuel fires intentionally set and carefully monitored. Fires provide an essential puzzle piece to help Mother Nature maintain healthy native grasses and open pine savannas. Those are our listening area's former dominant landscapes in the uplands. These are places where the sweet whistle of the northern bobwhite, the species we profiled earlier in this episode, would have been heard. So next time you see a prescribed fire or come across the black charred trunks of a pine tree, know that these might be some of the last holdouts for species like the bobwhite, wild turkey, red-cockaded woodpecker, Bachman's and Henslow's sparrow, Louisiana pine snake, pitcher plants, rare orchids, and many more kinds of plants and animals. So know that they're doing it for the birds.
All right. So thank you, Cliff. And one quick online question. Okay. Are there ravens in the Nacogdoches area?
There are no ravens. We have large black corvids, and they're all American crows.
Okay.
We have fish crows about an hour or two away. Probably closer to 2 hours away, but no, to get the closest raven to Nacogdoches, you're going to have to drive west to Austin and the Hill Country, and that's where you'll pick up your closest raven.
All yeah. Right. Cliff, I want to thank you for joining us tonight once again for Bird Calls.
Great. Enjoyed it.
You've been listening to Bird Calls with Cliff Shackelford, our resident ornithologist and the statewide non-game ornithologist for the Texas Parks and Wildlife Department. And we want to thank everyone at the Texas Parks and Wildlife Department for their help with this program tonight. Bird Calls is made possible by the Noel Foundation and the Community Foundation of North Louisiana. The producers for this show are Bill Beckett and Cliff Shackelford, with help from Wally Derleth, Renee Moran, Al Villarreal, and Henry Edwards. The audio for tonight's program will be posted to our website in the next few hours, and you can listen to this program again on our website at redriverradio.org. And remember, if you have a photo or sound clip that you'd like to send to Bird Calls, you can do so at my email address. That's wbeckett@lsus.edu.